Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 31st, 2008. We're live from 3 to 4 on our website of the Executive Intelligence Review News Service, which is www.larouchepub.com. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'll be host this hour. I'm with the Economic Section of EIR News Service, and our topic concerns the mission, the new sense of world mission of food for all. That is, we're going to vanquish any imperial elements that have been causing the crisis. We're now gripping the world. And we're so glad to have two people on us with us live. We have here in the studio, I welcome Rachel Douglas. Welcome.
Hi, Marcia.
From, many of you know, from our Russia desk, from our former Soviet Union desk, and with us for decades. And we also have, from the International LaRouche Youth Movement, from the War Room in the United States, Ali Parabikovsky. Ali, welcome.
Thanks, Marcia.
And many of you will be very aware that of among the events in the world in 3 days from now in Rome, beginning June 3rd, will be the Rome-based conference of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization that amounts to a summit on the food crisis, though it was called a year ago and focused on things like biofuels and how to have food security while meeting the climate change. In other words, these hoaxes and evil practices. But now, this occasion in Rome, where there'll be many heads of state, many delegations from about 80 nations, has become a moment in the battle that we've been mounting internationally. That instead of that, we should end the World Trade Organization years. We should end any form of this kind of thing, and we should go for doubling world food production. Many people have signed the call put out in the last 6 weeks by Helga Zepp LaRouche and the Schiller Institute. People are taking up the cause that Lyndon LaRouche said, just kill the WTO, don't prevaricate. And the situation has reached the stage where there are many initiatives that our guests will talk about, and Rachel, one of which is concerns the what's happening in Russia from a very important world strategic standpoint. But before we do that, Ali, if you could just describe some of the sense of action that I think is taking place right now in the United States and elsewhere in the way of town meetings and the new release that you were part of a team and producing on the food policy. Would you just give us a summary of that to begin with?
Sure. Well, I think the main thing is ever since Helga issued her call a few weeks ago, the intention has been all across the globe, internationally, the intention has been to make history, to intervene into the FAO conference and make sure that we take a stand to actually destroy the system of globalization that has ruined the our economic system, that has ruined this world over the last 40 years, and to actually avert this food crisis by doubling food. So to do that, we've had, over the last few weeks, intense mobilization, especially by members of the LaRouche Youth Movement. And this weekend is pretty critical going into the FAO conference next week. We have we had yesterday an International Day of Action, and we had rallies going on in downtown areas all over the world. We had people hitting up international consulates, and we had quite an important response, especially from foreigners who are, you know, in the United States or in other countries who are from the countries that are being worst hit by this food crisis. We've had tremendous response. We have one person who is from Haiti who's actually going to be doing a shadow conference at the FAO in Rome, where he will be reading Helga's statement to double food production. So this is going to continue. Today we have a series of town hall meetings. We have five going on in the United States today. And
did you say where they are?
LaRouche just finished recording a statement that will be played at all of these town hall meetings to address what is going to have to happen, not only going into the FAO, but what's going to have to happen afterwards coming out. On this policy statement, a few of us down here in the war room released a 2008 policy memorandum basically to put the real issues on the agenda at the FAO. This is the LaRouche Pact policy of what basically, just to go through it quickly, it develops the food crisis, how it has occurred, what is actually behind the development of this crisis, which is the globalization tactics of the British Empire, the WTO. And then it lists, of course, what needs to be done immediately to avert this crisis and what needs to be done in the future to assert a new financial architecture, to actually have a four nations come together, the Russia, China, India, and the United States, in order to create a new monetary system for the world. So we no longer have this system of imperialism which has brought on the food crisis. So in all, we're the ones dictating the solutions. And I think that's the main thing to stress. We are directly intervening into history right now.
Great. And you said that in the sense of an internet site, but that's, people can find what you just, the policy memorandum at www.larouchepac.com, LaRouchePac.com, and it will be available in the Executive Intelligence Review that's going to be posted online in a few days, and it will be dated, I think, June 7th. We'll also have in this important policy statement and many of the national initiatives from Argentina in the Congress, from Russia, from Japan that met with 52 nations in Yokohama. Mr. Fukuda met with leaders of 52 nations in Africa. Excuse me, they were there in Japan. And that brings us, Rachel, why don't you describe the kind of thing that's been going on in Russia in particular and in this strategic sense?
The Russian delegation to the FAO summit will be led by the agriculture minister, whose name is Alexei Gordeev, G-O-R-D-E-Y-E-V, Gordeev. This is an important decision to send a member of the new cabinet, actually a member of the presidium of the new cabinet, because since former President Putin became prime minister early in May, he and his colleagues have completely reorganized the Russian government and streamlined it in several ways, including the establishment of a presidium consisting of seven deputy prime ministers and the ministers from the most important government departments, such as defense, security, foreign ministry, and agriculture, which is certainly one of the most important departments. I want to present a little bit on this discussion of what Mr. Gordeev has had to say lately, because it is a marker of an extremely important policy debate going on in Russia. What's at stake is the survival of Russia and its ability to play a positive role in the world in shaping economic policies to replace the utterly failed policies of the last few decades. Actually, they failed so spectacularly in Russia, including in the agriculture sector, as Gordeev has made clear in his recent speeches, that it makes it quite an object lesson to go through. But I wanted just to say first that Helga's call that Ali mentioned, we also have circulated in the Russian language to a quite extraordinary response. On this occasion, we not only contacted our many friends in Russian economic and political circles, scientific circles from the Academy of Sciences, who are already on record as endorsers of the LaRouche movement-initiated call for a new Bretton Woods conference, a new monetary system that would favor the survival of nations and peoples rather than sacrificing them to the looting prerogatives of financier interests. But we also posted Helga's call, her article saying double food production, on our Russian website. Put an extra subtitle on it, which was actually directly from the article, saying the WTO should be disbanded. And we appended to that a request that people write in if they agree, anybody, and say what they thought. Well, the response was electric. This call, the article, was posted on dozens of websites and blogs in the Russian part of the internet. That means not only in Russia itself, but in Ukraine, in Central Asian countries where Russian is still kind of a lingua franca. People speak it because the education was in Russian during the Soviet period. This included the site of the Russian Anti-Globalist Resistance Organization. The call appeared on rpmonitor.ru, which is an influential news and analysis portal based in Russia. It appeared on Strategium, which is a policy analysis and deliberation site in Ukraine. And from these postings, there transpired individual endorsements, so that amongst the signatures that have been collected are Dr. Selezniov from the Academy of Sciences Institute for Social and Political Research, Felix Goryunov, who's a world-famous Russian economics journalist. He was actually the first Russian journalist accredited to cover the GATT.
Oh, my.
Right, the predecessor.
And he survived.
Yes, he survived and has signed Helga's call with pleasure, given what he's witnessed about the GATT and the WTO and trade in general. So this, as Ali said, our ability to inject the best ideas into such situations is absolutely the case in Russia and the former Soviet Union. Why? They have experienced the devastation of radical free trade policies at a faster rate than any place else in the world. I won't say to lower depth than any place else in the world because of the horrible levels of starvation in Africa, but very close to that. Marcia knows that in preparation of our latest package on the food situation in EIR magazine dated the 30th of May, we include some graphs with Mr. Gordievsky's recent presentation on Russian agriculture that show the recovery in some areas of production, agricultural production, since Putin became president in 1999-2000. But you have to see what level the recovery was from. And I took the opportunity to look back at a book that I translated and EIR published in 1999 called Genocide, Russia and the New World Order. The author is Sergei Glazyev, very well-known patriotic economist in Russia, who, by the way, day before yesterday, was elected full member of the Russian Academy of Sciences, which is certainly a happy development. We can maybe talk about that in a moment. But he documented in 1998, when he wrote the Russian version of Genocide, that the caloric consumption and vitamin consumption and meat consumption of the Russian population during the first 4 or 5 years of the imposition of what was called shock therapy.
So that'd be 91 to 5?
91 to 1995.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
This was when the so-called liberal reforms were done in a totally radical way. That is,
Jeffrey Sachs, these people.
Prices were decontrolled. Privatization was launched, and yet there was no infrastructure in place. And here I actually mean not only physical electric lines and rail, but organizational infrastructure for a free market economy. So you had criminalization, people taking advantage of the situation to jack up prices as high as they possibly could. You had 2,600% inflation in the year of 1992 alone, which wiped out people's savings, wiped out their ability to acquire food. And thus, you had a very serious drop in the diet of people living in Russia and Ukraine, and because similar things happened there generally. but also in the ability of agriculture to function. The old Soviet collective farms and state farms fell apart. In the period from 1991 to last year, fully one-third of the cropland under cultivation in 1991 in Russia was taken out of cultivation. The year 2000 census shows, for example, that there are 34,000 villages in the Russian countryside with a population in each village of fewer than 10 people. This may be two or three widows. You can find human interest stories in the press about these women trying to save the pasture land or the cropland personally by going out and weeding, hand weeding, in an attempt to stop the encroachment of the forest. This is the kind of thing that went on in the 1990s. The input of mineral fertilizer to Russian agriculture fell by 85% between 1991 and 1995. The number of tractors available to agriculture in Russia declined by 50% between 1991 and 1995. So you can see that for anybody thinking about the national security, it was evident and obvious that this question of food production had to be addressed. I'll just say very briefly about Mr. Gordievsky's presentation, and I will urge people to read this when it comes out in the EIR of May 30th, that it took place at a meeting held by Prime Minister Putin on the 19th of May, actually in a town down in the south of Russia. The famous Black Earth Belt extends from Ukraine, as you know. This is soil that's as good as Iowa.
Yeah. In fact, the classification of soils is in the Russian languages, right? Podzol and all these names.
Uh-huh.
It's all Russian nomenclature because figured it out first.
Well, also because Dmitry Mendeleev,
the
great railroad builder and the discoverer of the periodic law of the elements and one of the most energetic opponents of British free trade anywhere in the world in the whole last 30 years of the 19th century, was also a soil scientist. And when Dmitry Mendeleev came to the United States in 1876 to attend our famous centennial exhibition in Philadelphia, the two physical economy areas that he most prioritized were the oil industry, which had just started.
Pennsylvania, huh?
And the main state was not Texas at that time, but Marsh's home state of Pennsylvania, which has a place called Oil City
yeah.
in it, and soil science. So this is very much, yes, part of the story. But the Black Earth Belt goes east from Ukraine into an area in southern Russia just above the Caucasus Mountains, and it includes areas called Stavropol and Krasnodar. And the town of Yesentuki is in that region and is the location where Putin and Gordievsky held a meeting of the government on agriculture policy. And Gordievsky gave his presentation on the beginnings of a turnaround in terms of fertilizer inputs, various subsidies, not only price subsidies, but just activity subsidies, in making it possible for somebody to consider going into farming, to reclaim some of this land and start producing again. Most striking in their discussion was the principled question of questioning total free trade. That is, Gordievsky reported to Putin, both at Yesentuki, and actually they've had three meetings on this matter since the government took office on May 12th. It's very much a matter of concentration. Gordievsky reported that yields will be higher in Russian grain production in 2008. Why? Because of the imposition of export duties on mineral fertilizers in order to keep them in the country. And Prime Minister Putin, in his speech to that conference, laid out 5 interim objectives for Russian agriculture, the last one of which, I'll quote, he said, "We must have constant monitoring of the situation in food production, and if prices exceed established limits, there should be automatic measures, I mean purchasing interventions, regulation using import and export tariffs." So this brings us really to the whole question of the new Russian government. And
so it comes full around to what Ali was saying too, this question of the strategic point we're at to end any of this WTO free trade, because this 0.5 you mentioned, and even the subsidies are themselves against
even
the
saying principle. That is enough to give WTO bureaucrat a heart attack.
Well,
right there. I mean, people should realize that Russia has not joined the WTO. Now, this gets interesting because its Russian policy is to join it. And there have been ongoing negotiations and millions of demands on Russia to comply with various of these no-subsidy rules. And I think it's striking that just before the new government, the leadership change took place, and Dmitry Medvedev, who had been a deputy prime minister, was elected president. He is now president and sits in the Kremlin. And Putin was appointed by Medvedev to be president and did a broad rearrangement of his staff, bringing some of his closest associates, many of whom have an intelligence and security background, into the government, the cabinet per se, with him. But just before this change took place, the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, who's also a member of the presidium of the new government, said in one of his press conferences that Russia is not in a terribly terrible hurry to make agreements with international organizations on financial questions. In other words, he wasn't saying get lost yet to the WTO.
Yeah, we're looking for someone to turn their membership card in, but of course they aren't members yet. But you think it's not wrong to read into it something.
Well, I think that what he reflected in general terms is what you see concretely in the actions of Minister of Agriculture Gordieff and Prime Minister Putin. And I would propose thinking about this question of Putin's security and intelligence cabinet in a different way from how it's usually discussed.
From espionage and weapons.
Because one often hears, well, Putin is a Chekist, right? A Chekist comes from the Russian letters Cheka, which was meant extraordinary commission back in the 1920s and was the first incarnation of what was later known as the KGB. And so Putin, of course, had his own career as a KGB officer posted in Germany. And many of the current deputy prime ministers likewise have that kind of intelligence background. This is often portrayed as showing that Putin is authoritarian, brutal, not intrinsically inclined to be a free market guy, and therefore not the kind of person we want to do business with. And many, many of the talking head commentators looking at Russia have raised the question of the leadership change in terms of whether Medvedev, who's a lawyer, whose background is not in the security intelligence area, might be more liberal, might be more cooperative on some of these questions. And I think it's just the wrong way to think about it, because if you're sitting in a country which has experienced the kind of thing I just described in terms of the collapse and what I said with regard to mineral fertilizer inputs, this was true for Russian industry across the board. It was true for infrastructure. It was true for housing. All of these areas, you've had practically no investment for almost 15, 16 years in Russia. And anybody who's got his thinking cap on with regard to national security knows that and is going to address it in some way. Doesn't mean they automatically are going to have the right policy. But in my view, in that kind of a situation, it's not the worst thing in the world to have a bunch of guys whose background is intelligence and security running your government. Just examples include the amongst the new deputy prime ministers. You have two or three who have this kind of security background, but also look at this. One of the changes in the government was that Putin divided the Ministry of Industry and Energy into a separate Ministry of Industry and a separate Ministry of Energy. The new Minister of Energy is not an oil or a gas man, and you know that Russia has been able to exploit its huge revenues from the high oil prices, obviously, in the most recent years. But the new Minister of Energy is a military-educated nuclear power industry specialist, Sergei Shmatko, who has been the manager of Russia's company that constructs nuclear plants in other countries for export. The new head of the FSB, the current version of the KGB, is a man named Bortnikov, who has worked for 5 years as chief of economic security for the Russian services. So you get that kind of a picture. And I think that we can look at the very interesting remarks and serious mobilization by Gordeev and his ministry hand in hand with the fact that of the other meetings that Putin held in the first few days as prime minister, he went up to St. Petersburg, the famous window to the west cut through by Peter the Great with the founding of that port city in the 1700 to 1725 period in Russia. And he held there a meeting on the creation of a new state-owned corporation called the United Shipbuilding Corporation. And several of the members of the new government were there to discuss the need to revive actual construction of ocean-going vessels in Russia. This is one of the industries that had been totally wiped out during the 1990s. And then the day after the agriculture meeting down there in the south, Putin attended and addressed a conference called Transport 2008 in the Black Sea coast city of Sochi, which is where the 2014 Winter Olympics will be. So it's a big concentration of interest in investment. But the Transport 2008 conference that he addressed, he took as the occasion to announce what he called the most ambitious of all investment programs ever adopted by the Russian government. And this is the all branches, all types of transport to be funded to the tune of 13 trillion rubles, four and a half of that from the state budget. And this is to go up until the period 2015. Now, this, of course, overlaps something we talked about last year, which is the fact that Russia has adopted a rail development program, which includes segments of high-speed rail, not only around Moscow and St. Petersburg and the Olympics area at Sochi, but also in central Siberia, where there's raw materials and other resources that needs to move fast. And Russian Railways Company plan up to the year 2030 includes the railroad all the way to the Bering Strait and potentially the tunnel under the Bering Strait. And it includes the very interesting program called the Urals, the Industrial Urals, Polar Urals, which is for the industrialization of the whole North Ural, as it's called, mountain range there. So Putin was endorsing and expanding this whole perspective of building infrastructure. And I had the chance to listen to, and so did some of Ali's colleagues who are studying Russian. She already knows Russian. But we had a chance to listen to Putin at the end of this conference, and it was stunning. This was the Prime Minister of Russia saying, infrastructure. We must have infrastructure. Without infrastructure, there can be no development of the economy. Without infrastructure, we have no future. Now, picture what it says to a nation if the prime minister stands up and makes that kind of a speech. For me, that invokes the best history of the relationship between Russia and the United States, and thus what Ali said at the outset about mobilizing the combination of forces to utterly defeat the WTO and the entire murderous free trade regime actually can work if we revive that part of our history. If you take, I know in last week's program you discussed with Mary Birdman, the many facets of the relationship amongst the great Eurasian powers, that is, Russia as Eurasia's keystone nation, smaller population, bigger territory than the others, China and India, both with thousands of years of cultural history as well as a modern scientific capability, you know, in development. So you have those three, the so-called RIC, Russia, India, China. But the other great force, the United States, being the republic that it is, and the other transcontinental power. This is the combination that strikes terror into the hearts of the free traders. Again, just as it did 150 years ago when Tsar Alexander II sent the fleet to help defend the Union, defend the United States against the British support for the Confederacy. And of course, that victory of Lincoln in the Civil War was followed in the decades afterwards by the extraordinary economic development brought on in this country by the Transcontinental Railroad, and in Russia by the Transcontinental Railroad, the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which was conceived of by Mendeleev, the scientist, and his ally, Count Witte, as based on the American system principles, and was built in a way that challenged the British rule. I'll just give one footnote on this, which I just find fascinating. I was looking at this in connection with an article on it published in Russia last year, an article on Russian-American relations, written by a member of the Russian State Duma. Last year, 2007, was the 200th anniversary of diplomatic relations established in 1807 between the United States and Russia. So there were a number of such historical articles. But this one was extraordinary because the fellow mentioned the moment in which, when in 1867, Russia sold Alaska to the United States. And as I'm sure you know, there were people here who were skeptical about that, thought it was a waste of money. They called it Seward's icebox because the Secretary of State, Seward, had arranged the sale. But there was also opposition in Russia, people saying, well, we shouldn't give away this big chunk of territory. Why should we give this away? And the author last year from the Russian State Duma, his name was Fomienko, who wrote this article, he said that the people in favor of having sold Alaska to the United States argued for it by saying, oh, no, it's very important that we do this. Because this way the Americans, the USA, will have their continental, what we now call the lower 48 territory, and Alaska, and they can box in the British interests on the continent, and we can't handle that right now. This is long before the Trans-Siberian had been built, and Alaska is very far from Moscow. We can't handle that right now, so it's actually excellent and important that the USA will have Alaska and can do this, have this political advantage.
Well, it's been quite a fight all these decades and centuries, and that is. Thank you very much for the sense of what's coming to Rome on June 3rd with the Russian delegation. I'll just say, because this isn't a chess game here, but I will say the U.S. delegation. For people who hadn't noticed, because there's no coverage of this in the general CNN, Fox News world of the U.S., Ed Schaefer is the Secretary of Agriculture, and the head of the USAID from the State Department are going to head the U.S. delegation, and their remarks Thursday couldn't be more opposite, totally within the realm of let's have more favorable free trade and give out a little aid and let's do this and that. So it's dismal. But otherwise, we have, however, on the streets, on the campuses, among science networks, too, beginning a kind of organizing in North America, in the U.S., and all around the world. And, Allie, do you want to add something on that in the sense of what the War Room has been involved in fostering of a kind of organizing blitz of contacting around Helga Zeplerush's call, but in general, to this point of view of the strategic potential with Russia, China, India, with now Japan and Africa making initiatives. Could you just fill in what you think is important to be made known to people about the sense of organizing here in the U.S.?
Yes, sir. Well, I mean, the main thing is, like you said, in the U.S., all over the world, there's a big, huge split going into the FAO conference, a big, huge split between the people who are for free trade. This is the financial, elite people for the policy of biofuels. There's this split between them and then the faction that's us, representing the American system, Lyndon LaRouche. That faction, and also now there's this new coming out faction in the Russia, China, India bloc. And that's really the fight. That's really the fight that we're going into. And I think the biggest thing is we've been very open with this in our organizing in the United States and all over the world, actually, that there is an explicit fight right now between us, the people allied with Lyndon LaRouche, the people who actually want to create a future for humanity, that is without imperialism, destroys, this British imperialism that has basically ruined our economy and destroyed the livelihood of millions of people all over the world. And there's this fight going on between that faction and the British faction, the British Empire financial oligarch faction, who have been trying to not only take our economy down, but also they've been basically pushing the Lisbon Treaty and other such empire rules all over the world. So that's what we actually have to rip open. We have to rip open the divisions between those two factions. And that's what we've been doing. We've been going very explicitly in our organizing with the British Empire. What's actually behind the food crisis? What has actually created this food crisis? It's a fallacy in the way that the population is thinking. It's a fallacy in the way that the population is controlled by this British Empire faction. And that's the problem. That's what has basically stopped us from completing the kind of development projects that, Russia right now is looking at, the kind of development projects that we had in the United States during the time of Franklin Roosevelt. Ever since his death, all of that has been taken down. The actual view of looking towards the future, of actually, nations collaborating together to be able to solve problems that come up and to be able to make future generations, to be able to make their lives better, that does not exist anymore.
One of the very striking things, Ali, when I think about the FDR moment and the way in which Franklin Roosevelt revived the knowledge of our own history, mm-hmm. there had been attempts to wipe it out, through bringing the United States in on the world on the British side in World War I, through the demoralization of the Depression, building up this image that this is really somewhat inevitable and that maybe we might have to have fascism like Mussolini in Italy to deal with it. And Roosevelt came in with something that had been on ice for decades, but not that long ago, had been the lifeblood of our country, namely the American system of economics.
Yes.
And when we first were able to go into Russia to organize, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, these were the ideas that we brought. I was just reviewing this week, in connection with Sergei Glazyev's election to the Academy, the transcript of a seminar which Mr. LaRouche held in Moscow in 1996 in April. And this was formally at the something called the Free Economic Society. It was chaired by two academicians, members of the Russian Academy of Sciences. And I'll just mention for people on the history that the Academy of Sciences was not founded yesterday. The Academy of Sciences was founded by Peter the Great, or just on the design of Peter the Great on orders, really the year that Peter died in 1725, but according to an outline given to him by the great German philosopher and scientist Leibniz, the same Leibniz who was so influential and critical for the American Republican movement in Ben Franklin's time. So you really have something shared there. And that the Academy of Sciences has been a bulwark, an institution of the Russian nation and the Russian national identity through all the 300 years since then, through all the ups and downs of good czars, bad czars, good alliances, such as with Lincoln during the Civil War, bad situations like what happened after the defeat of Napoleon. I mean, the defeat of Napoleon was good, but the Congress of Vienna that set up the so-called balance of power, Holy Alliance with Russia as the gendarme of Europe in 1815, that was not such a good alliance. The Soviet period, which was very different while having certain aspects that continued earlier features of Russian history. But all the way through that, the Academy of Sciences existed and always, not that every last academician was a great guy, but always was a place from which the best minds of Russia could influence the fate of the nation. The famous academician Vernadsky, who lived from 1863 to 1945, died the same year as Roosevelt, and is a very good friend of LaRouche, I would say, in terms of the dialogue of ideas that can occur even after one of the thinkers is no longer, has ended his mortal life, that the Academy played this role. Well, two leading members of the Academy, academician Abalkin, who at that time, Leonid Abalkin, was the head of the Economics Institute of the Academy, and academician Osipov, head of the Institute for Social and Political Research, chaired a seminar featuring Mr. LaRouche as the main speaker under the title Russia, the United States, and the Global Financial Crisis. This was April 1996. And Lyndon led the presentation with reference to Franklin Roosevelt's vision of the post-war world, Roosevelt's utter commitment to the elimination of colonialism in all its forms, to make sure that on the shards of the Dutch colonies, the British colonies, the Portuguese colonies in Africa, in Asia, in Southwest Asia, in the Near East area, that real nations with economic development and betterment of their populations could arise. And Mr. LaRouche laid that out to the Russian audience. These were very top people. It included now deceased, the last prime minister of the Soviet Union was in that seminar, ex-prime minister Pavlov, many others from the Academy of Sciences. And what Mr. LaRouche laid out is that we can and must bring those ideas of Roosevelt to life again. Now, mind you, this was 1996. These were not the leading ideas in the Russian government circles. The first post-Soviet government under President Yeltsin was run by radical free traders. So this was, in a sense, an opposition meeting, but not a political opposition. It was an idea, an institutional opposition to rotten, murderous policies. And thus, Mr. LaRouche's dialogue with leading Russian scientific circles has been very much a factor in the reemergence of Russia's claim to its own history, because what FDR revived also exists in the Russian tradition because of Mendeleev, because of Count Witte and the Trans-Siberian Railway. These ideas were, again, in their case, put on ice or used partially or in a distorted way under the Soviet system. But they exist and they can be revived, and they have been revived. Not necessarily that every single speech by every government official begins with quoting Count Witte, but it is the case that President Putin, when he was still president, quoted Franklin Roosevelt repeatedly in his speeches, in his message to the Federal Assembly, in his famous speech to the Munich Security Conference, which was covered in the press as if it were a saber-rattling Cold War speech. It wasn't. It was a realistic evaluation of the danger of a big war, which he knows and we know is the agenda for Dick Cheney and other friends of London, for all of Eurasia and all of the world. So he addressed those matters, but he also cited Roosevelt. And in fact, in early 2007, when it was the 125th anniversary of FDR's birth, the celebration held in Moscow was bigger than anything held in the United States. There was a conference held at the Moscow State Institution for International Relations, which is known by its Russian acronym MGIMO. Sounds funny in English, but sounds normal in Russian. MGIMO. And it was on the significance of FDR for today. And it was addressed not only by economists, but by a young advisor to Putin named Vladislav Surkov, who was the deputy chief of the Kremlin administration and who is still in President Medvedev's administration as an aide. And for any cynics who might have snuck into our listening audience, this was not dedicated to Roosevelt on the grounds of allowing Putin to run for a third term. It was dedicated to Roosevelt on the grounds of invoking his ideas about the role of the state in the economy, of guiding economic policy in the national welfare, and about justice in relationship among countries in the world. So that those are signs of the way the ideas from this same arsenal, from the same tradition, from national economy, from the idea of the community of principle, as John Quincy Adams put it. John Quincy Adams, another person who had a lot to do with Russia. President Adams, sometime before serving as president, had been our ambassador to Russia, was extremely intellectually involved with the spread of these and similar nation-building and philosophical ideas in Russia. Another instance is that in 2005, a quite prominent journalist, the editor-in-chief of Expert magazine, Expert, as it's called, really the leading economics weekly in Russia, whose name is Fadyeev, brought out a small book of three translations. And the three translations were Friedrich List's National Economy, List, of course, being the German economist and organizer of industry who visited the United States, worked with the Careys, as in Henry Carey, founded the customs union in Germany in 1834, the famous Zollverein, which began to unify Germany as a nation, and whose ideas were at the heart of what Chancellor Bismarck did in the late part of the 19th century for the industrialization of Germany and the building of infrastructure, including the idea of the Berlin to Baghdad Railroad, for which his ouster was orchestrated by London. So List's works were very, very closely studied in Russia, and this small volume by Fadyeev included List's main piece under that title, National Economy. Then it included a pamphlet written by Count Witte in 1890 or 91, when Witte was finance minister, on why we must study Friedrich List and implement his policies in Russia. The tendency in Russia was to discuss the American system in terms of Listian ideas, especially as that became very much the topic of interest in Europe. But they were equally identified by these Russian circles as American ideas, as we know from Mendeleev having gone to the Philadelphia exhibition and from Henry Carey's works, really from earlier, from the 1850s on, being translated into Russian and published and circulated in Russian magazines in the 1850s, in the 1860s, within months after they would come out in English. So this pamphlet was included in the volume, and the third item in Fadyeyev's book is Mendeleev's famous report on a tariff from 1891, which explains why you must take action to protect your industry, protect your food production and population, that this doesn't mean you're attacking other countries, but it's strengthening your own nation in a way that is conducive then to arrangements in the mutual interest. And this is a point that Mr. LaRouche has made every time he's addressed an audience in Russia and many other places as well, that if you have protectionist policies in many countries, that doesn't mean you have a trade war. If you have a community of principle, such as John Quincy Adams expressed really the earlier what we call the Westphalian principle of acting in the interest of the for the benefit of the other, then you can have nations by agreement acting in their mutual interest, as long as you get rid of the WTO and the murderous Malthusian maniacs who want to reduce the population on this planet to 1 billion people. So I have great hope and confidence that these ideas can be revived also on the agenda of the Rome meeting next week through the participation of the Russian delegation, the kind of special participation that Ali mentioned with the people we've encountered in the mobilization in this country.
Right, as you said, from Haiti and elsewhere. Ali may know more. I think Mr. Fukuda from Japan may be going there after this 3-day meeting with dozens of nations from Africa, and Mr. Fukuda pledged that Japan will help double rice production in the continent of Africa. Their goal is within 10 years. That would be from 14 million tons to 28 million. It's not just a tonnage issue, but what that presupposes about the ability, the productivity to be raised is just the kind of process you're saying in different particulars for the big, huge nation of Russia. So let me ask Ali in the remaining minutes. I mean, we still have 9 minutes or less, 8 maybe. But are there any special points of uptake, I mean, themes, or among the reactions of people is what I'm saying, that you know are taking place to our LaRouche Youth Movement organizers, whether it's in Texas or Boston or Seattle? Are there any recurring themes, like mostly young people say, sure, why shouldn't we grow food? Or, oh, well, we never could do, you know, you'll get the older cynics. Let's discount that. Or are people especially interested when you say, look at what's going on with Russia and China and India? I mean, where is the interest? Is there such a pattern you can, or anything like that you can bring out?
Well, I mean, for the most part, you know, right now this crisis, it's about food.
Yeah.
It's quite personal for people, really.
Yeah, yes. I noticed you could say you began with a quote in that in your new policy paper. Everyone should look it up.
Yeah, we did, with Lyndon LaRouche's quote, actually. See, the main thing is, we are literally providing these ideas that Rachel was talking about. These are solutions for not only how to deal with the food crisis, but how to deal with, you know, actually how to develop entire nations. This is what gets young people really excited, because, you know, most of the time what young people are told in school, other places, all over, you know, wherever they are, they're pretty much told, you know, you live, there's obviously overpopulation, things suck for people all over the world, and then, you know, you die. And it's this very demoralizing attitude. There's very little hope coming out. But the thing is, what we're doing is we're providing a solution to destroy this imperial faction that has created the free trade policies that have created the food crisis, and instead to adopt policies where nations can cooperate to green the deserts, for example. you know, to go to Mars. We have the ability to have amazing projects, you know, play around with what's going with the universe in a sense. And it's, I wanted to just bring out quickly, Helga LaRouche, yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, she was on a radio show and she was interviewed and she said that what we could do potentially if nations were to come together at this FAO conference and beyond and declare an emergency, emergency meetings basically to stop hunger. We could stop hunger within a half a year. And she said poverty, I think, within 5 years and within one generation have be on our way to a completely revolutionary, decent standard of living. This is really the biggest thing with the organizing. This is what young people react to. The fact is we don't have to have, we don't have to be in this kind of economic crisis. We don't have to. Right now, we can declare we're going to get out of it.
Right.
We're going to kill the WTO. We're going to stop biofuels insanity. We're going to stop the Malthusian hoax of, you know, destroying your population. And we can actually have nations collaborate together to develop the world, have amazing scientific projects. This is possible right now. And it's what needs to be done right now, because otherwise civilization just goes down the drain. And this is why we need everybody to organize their governments, their, you know, state reps, organize their food banks, farmers, everybody they know, in order to make sure that civilization is not destroyed, in order to make sure that we can actually have a positive future, because we can do it. That's the amazing thing, and that's what people are responding to. We can do it.
That's great. I just think that's so much what Americans need to hear, isn't it? And a colleague to me mentioned something to me yesterday, which brought home how ripe the situation is for our fellow citizens to change their thinking in the way that people in Russia have begun to change their thinking after the devastation they experienced. And that is that many Americans are dealing with $4 a gallon gas, not by driving less, but by eating less, by cutting back on their food consumption. And you know, people want to get out of that trap. And it just brings you back to the fundamental clash of ideas. You know, at the beginning of the last century, you can cite two books that were written in the first, just 100 years ago. I think it was 1902 or so, H.G. Wells, the British imperial maniac, author of The Shape of Things to Come and so on, wrote that 80% of the population will simply fall into the abyss. That they will be written off, and only, this was on behalf of a eugenics, you know, the perspective of just the better races, you know, surviving. In the same decade that horrible tract was published, Dmitry Mendeleev, the wonderful Russian scientist, in the last year of his life, wrote a book on the future of Russia, in which he said that Russia alone must have half a billion people, 500 million people, even to function. Now, today it only has 142 million. But in 1906, Mendeleev said Russia needs 500 million people to function at all. And he particularly, like Witte, developed a polemic in favor of population density, not just numbers of people, but density of people, saying that people living close to each other in cities makes for a better cross-fertilization of ideas. Mm-hmm. And that's what mankind lives by, unlike any other species.
Right. It's very much that, there's so many cross-examples, like Henry Carey writing about the countryside. He would use Pennsylvania as an example or elsewise, but and the number of people and the advantages to the small distances, and the, you know, so obviously you need enough people, especially if you're going to have density in the size of the Russian nation. Well, we still have the last remaining minutes, and I don't have some special point, but I'd like to reiterate that people should get this policy memorandum. Allie, what's the exact title again that the on from the LaRouche Political Action Committee?
It's LaRouche PAC Food Policy Memorandum of 2008. Kill the WTO and double food production.
Well, that is what we need to hear at the very last. We've run out of time. And, and this is that you can find also call. Some listen by phone. Call 800-929-7566. 800-929-7566 for that. And to give your resources to that and your effort, as Rachel and Allie have said. And thank you so much, Rachel Douglas, Allie Parabikovsky, on May 31st, 2008, with the close of the LaRouche Show today. And on June 7th, we hope to have a diplomat from China who's based in Washington, D.C., and our guest host will be Mike Billington with the IR News Service from the Asia Desk. And do listen, that will be the LaRouche Show, June 7th, 2008. So this is Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Thank you very much, and we hope this week shifts the whole world based on Rome and thereafter. Thank you.
Thanks, Marcia.